colors. What is a ninja?
A ninja is one who can use everything around him to trick his enemies. He is fast, and he is friendly to his environment.
A ninja is honest and good. His mind, body, and spirit are one. He has self-control. He has discipline.
A ninja loves nature, because she is fond of nature. A ninja never fights a battle if he cannot win.
A ninja. Mind, body, spirit, heart are one. And never use power on anyone weaker than yourself.
Gonna sleep, sleep, sleep in my ninja pajamas. Dream real sweet in my ninja pajamas. I look so neat in my ninja pajamas. Until the sun, till the sun comes up again. Till the sun comes up again. I got a kung fu grip. And everybody knows you sleep in pajamas, not in your clothes. My ninja PJs make me invisible, which means you can't see me. But if you want, you can be just like me. Be just like me.
Be just like me.
With my ninja PJs by the bedside, I put them on, I get quiet inside. I feel the strength of a silent mountain. My love's overflowing like a great big fountain. Bedtime's here now, I'm at peace, deep with myself in the world's heartbeat. See you in the morning, maybe in my dreams, and be there in the cosmic stream.
Gonna sleep, sleep, sleep in my ninja pajamas. Dream real sweet in my ninja pajamas. I look so neat in my ninja pajamas. Until the sun, till the sun comes up.
Boys, but I know better. Yes, I know better. Like a cat in the night, sometimes I take flight. Jumping high and low, so silently I go. Side to side, around, upside down. I always land with my feet on the ground. I stay centered, that's how I do it. Calm my mind, let my fears unwind. Girls got style, girls got grace. Girls got a ninja suit made out of black lace. And just like water, I go with the flow. I'm all zen from my head to my toes.
Sleep, sleep, sleep in my ninja pajamas. Dream real sweet in my ninja pajamas. I look so neat in my ninja pajamas. Until the sun, until the sun comes up again. Until the sun comes up again.
Good evening, good day, good afternoon, good morning. Whatever it is, I hope it's good for you. This is Justin Harlan, a.k.a. The Painted Man, a.k.a. the guy who runs this podcast. I apologize for how long it's been since the last podcast, but I think it's been worth the wait. I have a couple great guests lined up. Before I talk about today's guests, I'll mention that I have Hayden Shaw coming on. I actually already talked to him, so I'm working on getting that podcast all finished up. That'll probably be up next week. And I have a few other ones coming up. And a bit of news that the Far Out Kids cast first episode is just about done and is also going to go up this week. Which, if you're not aware, that is the podcast that my son Cash is the host of. And I'm doing my best to let him run the show. It's his first episode, so I had to help him out a little more. But within the next couple episodes, I think he's going to pretty much take the reins, and I'm just going to be along for the ride. So I hope you check that out, especially if you have kids. Even if you don't, it'll probably be a good listen. It's a lot of fun. Cash is more entertaining than me, just like all my guests. They're better than me to listen to anyway, which I've explained to you guys many, many times. If you're new, thanks for checking us out. And if you're not new, thanks for coming back. So today's guests are Leon Korkos and Eric Bresler. Leon is an independent filmmaker who I stumbled across because of Victor Wong. If you're not familiar with Victor Wong, you actually are familiar with Victor Wong. Victor Wong is Grandpa Mori in the Three Ninjas movies. He is the wise old sage type crazy Asian dude. He's kind of like Rafiki from Lion King personified in like a dozen other movies. And I explained a little bit of the project I'm doing with Victor Wong at the helm. And we talk about Victor. And Leon definitely has a lot of fun stuff to say. And actually he's going to hook us up with Victor Wong's nephew, I believe it is, to talk as well, which is going to be even more Victor Wong-ness. Then we've got Eric Bresler, who is from the Philomoka. If you're not familiar with the Philomoka, that is the Philadelphia Mausoleum of Contemporary Art. It's as cool and weird as it sounds. Eric is also the programmer for the Cinadelphia Film Festival, which is based out of the Philomoka. And that's why we were talking, because that starts this week. So, and if you're listening to this when it came out, it's this week. If you're listening to it a little bit later, it might have already started. So check out all the different events over at the Cinadelphia website. You'll see in the show notes a bunch of links, so click them. Appreciate that. I guess without further ado, I will roll into this episode, and I appreciate you guys sticking around. I hope that you come back next week to hear Hayden Shaw, and I hope that you come back forever and ever. I want to be your friend. And I'm going to stop rambling now. So take it away, Rocky Garibay, with the Farsighted theme song, As You Were.
You're not sick, Amelia, no.
No?
No, you're a little farsighted.
My name is Leon Korkos. Started out as an indie filmmaker and commercial producer. I've done a few movies. Anyway, I got a call from Justin because he's doing a crazy project about the films of Victor Wong. My film, The Devil Takes a Holiday, was a small independent film in the 90s that I did with Vic. Not Victor's most well-known film, but as Victor told me, it was the most fun he's ever had, so that's the good news.
Well, that is good news. That's awesome. And I can see why. It was definitely a lot of fun. Did you write that film as well?
I did.
Okay. I thought I had read that as a credit of yours, that you had written that, as well as the two short films that you had sent me. I assume you wrote those ones as well?
Yes, sir.
Great, great. And are those your only three films that you had directed, or am I missing one or two?
No. Those are pretty much, I cut my teeth, basically I cut my teeth doing commercial work and then.
Okay. And now you do production, I guess. I noticed that you're.
Yeah, I produce. Yeah, the last few things I've done has been as a producer or executive producer and, it's not as much fun as directing. In fact, I don't consider producing fun at all, but it is what it is.
You know, actually, just before I go on, because I'm not, I'm not a film industry insider. What's the difference between being a producer and an executive producer?
It kind of depends. But realistically, the producer, think of the producer like a land developer.
Okay.
Okay? So the producer finds, quote, the property, quote, script/land, right? Okay. And then he takes the thing and finds everything that goes along with it, the financing, you know, the bank, the financing, the actors, the contractors, whatever. So the producer is pretty much the person that shepherds the project from square one. Okay.
Gotcha.
An executive producer can be anything from the people who put up the money to the guy who knows the guy who knows the guy who knows the guy, right?
Okay, so like you're helping with some connection or something. Yeah.
Yeah, or you're somebody that helped in the early stages of development, like they needed a little bit of money to get the script written, blah, blah, blah. Or you're an actor, or you're an actor that's involved in the project and you give them executive producer credits, they like that, and they may or may not get movie points as a producer. It's
okay.
a lot of ego stroking.
So executive producer can mean a lot of things.
Yeah,
it
can be as simple as the guy who the man or woman that works at Universal, and you know you're shepherding this project through Universal Studios. You get some co-producer, executive producer credit.
The producer is the one who's kind of more intimately involved than the actual producer.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, in most cases.
Right. That makes sense. And, you know, I always wondered the difference between different, production titles because I've never worked in the industry, I didn't know. But as a director and writer of the other films, you were obviously most intimately involved because, you wrote the script and you did all the direction. I'll start real quick with those two short films because I watched them, and then I want to talk about Devil Takes a Holiday.
Okay.
So the two short films I watched, one of them has an Italian name. What is it?
La Scala di Vino.
Yes. And so that was hilarious, actually. I was laughing a lot watching that. And initially, I noticed like the tone made it feel like it was going to be this little art house thing. And then I noticed that, everybody was dubbed in English and the dialogue was over the top ridiculous at many points. It was a lot of fun. I really, really enjoyed that. I'm assuming obviously the dubbing was actually part of the actual project.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't actually record it and then dub it for another audience.
Right. The whole thing was basically like when I was in my 20s, I was a big fan of, like, Lena Wertmuller movies.
Okay.
Where, where the guy slaps around his wife and that kind of stuff,
Yeah.
So, La Scala di Vino was just, they were actually speaking English. We just, if you had a lip reader, they could tell you what they said. They were actually speaking English. And all they knew is that they kind of had to talk long enough to cover, 5 seconds or something of dialogue. So they were speaking, they could say anything, English words for 5 seconds. They knew what they had to cover. So, yeah, the whole intent was to make fun of how ridiculous the 1970s Italian movies were once they were dubbed into English.
Okay. Yeah, as I'm not as horribly familiar with 70s Italian movies, what it did remind me of as well is those ridiculous like telenovela things from that I saw on the Spanish channel growing up.
Yeah. I strongly suggest you watch some Lena Wertmuller movies from the 70s. I think you'd enjoy. They're pretty funny actually, but yeah.
That's awesome. Well, it dubbing can always make something that's not even intentionally funny.
Yeah.
I watch some very serious movies for film club post thing that I'm part of, and I didn't realize I was initially that the option was to in the program I was using. I think I was watching Netflix. I didn't realize that it had it in subtitles. I thought that the dubbing was the only version it had, so I was watching the dubbing and I was laughing the whole time. And then this is not supposed to be funny.
Right.
And then I realized that I could turn off the subtitles, put it back in its original language, and I did, and it was like a whole completely different movie for the second half. So,
yeah.
And the other film that short film you did, oh God, why am I going blank on the name? Mother's Day, right? Oh no, that's one of the new films. Nailing Coffin. Nail and Coffin. That makes more sense. Now I remember now.
Yeah. That was just another. That was just a weekend. Me and some friends were bored. So we decided we wanted to make a short film, and that was that one. That was a lot.
At the end of that, there was a little like blurb. Was that based on something real?
I made it all. It's all made up.
Oh, you made it all up. Okay, cool. Because I thought it was like, I was like, is that based on some real true story?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it could have been, right? I mean, the setup of the whole thing is conceivably, but I just wrote it up, and then I made that little poem at the end to kind of close the thing out, yeah.
So the first short came before Devil Takes a Holiday, and then the Nail and Coffin was after.
Yeah. And there's a couple of other shorts, too, that I didn't link you to, but, you know, maybe I did, I don't know, I think I gave you, I don't know, anyway, it doesn't matter.
You sent me short some other shorts and things that you had produced, too, and...
Yeah, shorts are fun because there's not a lot. You can get your friends and you can get some people that you know who have talent to cop to a weekend or maybe 2 weekends just to have some fun. Because there's short films are a dead end financially. I mean, films just let's do something fun and see what we can knock out.
Right. It's not to make money. It's just because to entertain yourself. Hopefully entertain some other people in the process.
Right.
You know, I totally get that. And yeah, and I was entertained by both. So you did accomplish that goal.
Good.
Now, Devil Takes a Holiday, that particular film, obviously a full-length feature film, featured Victor Wong, as we just mentioned. And who were some of the other actors in that film that maybe were any of the other ones named that anyone would recognize?
Probably not. They might recognize her faces. I mean, the lead guy, Robert Miranda, his claim to fame was, he was in Midnight Run. He played the bad guy in Midnight Run. He was in Rocket Man. He's in a few movies, but you know, he typically plays.
Victor's a notable name, at least now as it goes. I don't know how much had he done at that point. That was after Big Trouble in Little China, right?
Oh, Victor. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Let me tell you how I met Victor. This will put everything into perspective.
Great.
Okay. Victor, well, you know, at the time I was living in Sacramento, right? Mm-hmm. And Victor and his wife ran a daycare center for kids.
That's awesome.
And it's like I had little kids, and he had just finished. Was it Ninja Turtles or something like
Three Ninjas.
Yeah, he just finished Three Ninjas, and I had little boys, and they were like, "Dad, look, that's Grandpa from Three Ninjas." And I thought, "Well, you got to be crazy." And there he was, right? So Victor and his wife ran a daycare center for kids in Sacramento. That's how I hooked up with Vic, and he was just he was like, "Yeah, let's have some fun. Let's do something. I don't have to leave town." Blah 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 blah. It was a really weird. Kismet-like connection that just didn't, you know, wasn't supposed to have us crazy.
So was that role actually, like, written for him?
Yeah, kind of, because I was in the process of writing the script when I ran into him, and we just thought, you know, that'd be kind of funny to get have Vic do that, yeah.
It felt very him. I you know, he has, like, this real knack for playing, you know, the old wise, you know,
yeah.
You know,
yeah, exactly. Well, he's got you know, Vic had an, I don't know how much you know about his background before movies.
Not very much.
Well, you know, it was a lot of fun. He grew up in San Francisco, okay? And his father was the mayor of San Francisco Chinatown.
Wow.
And so Victor took me to San Francisco for a tour, and, you know, everybody in Chinatown knows Vic because he grew up there and his dad was the mayor and blah, blah. He still had an apartment in Chinatown above one of those Chinese markets. But Vic was a still photographer and for the newspaper. And then he became a news photographer for one of the TV stations. And I want to say during like a press junket, he met, and I don't know which director he met, and the guy goes, "Oh, you got to audition for me for a movie." And I don't remember which one it was.
Mm-hmm.
And because Vic, when he was younger, he had a stroke and gave him Bell palsy. That's why he's got that weird face, because he had he had a Bell's palsy attack. But, you know, Vic comes across as the wise old sage, but, man, Victor was a wild dude in his youth, you know. You know, I mean, he hung out with all the beat poets. He was a major stoner and a lot of heavy psychedelic drugs.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I remember reading that he hung out with several of the beat poets, like some of the bigger names, too, and that's really cool. You know, he definitely seems like I hadn't known his whole background, but I definitely read a couple little things, you know, Wikipedia stuff and whatnot. And it's definitely really funny that that he was kind of a wild man, despite the fact that he came off as this wise old sage, even when he wasn't that old. I feel like, you know,
yeah,
he probably had that appearance of being this, you know, wiser than his age kind of guy, you know. And maybe part of it is that appearance of, from the Bell's palsy, or maybe some of it's just the way he carries himself. I don't know, but I very much think that he always nailed that down. And, you know, he's not necessarily that in every role, obviously, but so many of his roles have that feel to them. And even when he's kind of a crazy old man, he's still espousing wisdom.
He got kind of typecast.
Right. And he reminds me of kind of like the human version of Rafiki from Lion King. Just kind of crazy, but always saying something that's really profound. So
he was a fun guy. Vic was a great guy, but he was an interesting. He was a very, 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 very diverse in his interests. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I want to ask you what were some of your inspirations in writing that script? Because that was a pretty wacky story.
I think it was just a stupid idea that came to fruition, and then some of my friends and I decided maybe it's not that stupid, and in hindsight it was pretty stupid.
I don't know. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, but you know the other critics were not quite as kind to us. I mean, it became a little bit of a cult thing. There was a, you know, we were in some festivals. It was sort of a cult thing, but it was a little too weird. It is what it is. You learn
as
you go.
Did it ever get picked up for any type of distribution or anything?
Yeah, it had a couple of distributors early on. Right when, you know, as timing would have it, toward the end of the 90s, that was the beginning, if you remember correctly, that was the beginning of the end of VHS and so it was all timing. Yeah, we was distributed for a while. It was more of a fun thing than it was really like anything else. And it was a proof to some of us that we could actually knock this out and do it. You know, when you're making commercials, everyone who makes commercials that wants to make movies is like, can't go to bed at night until they go, I gotta do it. You know, and then you do it, and then you're going to bed going, I gotta sell it. So there's no, you know, it's not very, it's not a peaceful.
I could see that. That makes sense. And so nowadays, you said you're doing more, you know, producer stuff, and you said not as enjoyable, but you've been involved in some projects that seem quite a bit larger than what you did as a director.
Yeah.
So what are some of the projects that, I know, I think you have one coming out this year, one that came out a year or two ago. What are some of those projects that people actually might have seen?
Well, okay. So, I mean, where do I want to start on that? Like, I got life, you know.
Yeah, wherever you want to start.
Okay, so I'll go backwards. Okay, coming out in May on Mother's Day is a film I got involved with called Mother's Day with Jennifer Aniston and Julia Roberts and Jason Sudeikis. It's a gigantic cast. It's directed by Gary Marshall, who the guy's been around since, you know, Happy Days.
Yeah.
And he's in his 80s, and I'm doing another film with him. We're in pre-production of another film called Diamond Dogs, because Gary's in his 80s, he still plays softball, and he wanted to do a film about softball, and so we're working on that. You know, I'm in an executive producer on that. I got in really early in the embryonic stages of development, So, you know, I didn't even go to the set. So it's not like I've got my hands in the pie on that one, right? It's just I got involved early.
You're more in the conceptual phase of everything when it was all kind of getting...
Exactly. So then about 2.5 years ago, got involved in a film called Stretch with Jessica Alba, Chris Pine, Patrick Wilson, Ed Helms, and a companion, through the director, who's Joe Carnahan, who Joe and I go way, way back. In fact, if you look at Devil Takes a Holiday credit, he's an associate producer on that. Joe used to be my intern.
Oh, wow.
You know, back in the late or early 90s, Joe was going to college. He was my intern. So Joe and I go way, way back. So Stretch was a Joe film. Then, you know, in the 90s, I produced with him, the film Blood, Guts, Bullets, and Octane that basically launched his career. I want to say that was 98. Okay? Got picked up at Sundance. It launched his career. So, you know, we go in and out of working together on stuff for the last 10, 15 years.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, that's what I'm doing.
Cool. Are you at any point looking at, you know, writing or directing again, or are you kind of out?
No, yeah, I'd love to. I mean, I'm constantly writing. I write all the time. But the reality is the industry has changed to the point where, man, you don't, I mean, look what's out there now.
Right.
If you want to talk about what's out in the theaters, right, it's action tentpole films because they have to have virtually no story, you know, because they have to be able to be understood in China and Russia and Germany and Poland, right? So
right.
That's why it's all these superhero movies, right?
Yeah.
Anything else has got to be made for cheap enough to where
you can recoup real easily. Yeah.
Yeah. So like when we did Stretch with Jason Blum, Blumhouse, right? And
right.
Blumhouse has got a churning machine where they churn out basically horror movies.
Right. Oh, I'm a big Blumhouse guy. And in fact, actually, I kind of see Jason Blum as a lot like his model, very similar to the old Roger Corman.
Absolutely.
So, but
it's a ridiculous model. It's very Roger Corman like, but you know, Jason does movies that will have 5 or 6 sequels, and then hopefully he'll find another one that'll have 5 or 6. So all of his movies, I think, you know, how many Purge movies are going to be able to do? How many of those things are going to be able to? But yeah, so we did Stretch with Blumhouse. Stretch should have been a lot more expensive than it was, but, you know, we pinched pennies and the thing got done, and, yeah, I don't know if that was if it hurt it or didn't hurt it, but, you know, you have no idea. So,
yeah.
You know, Stretch has done okay on demand, and we were supposed to get a theatrical release, but it didn't happen, so we thought for sure, you know, that's what I'm saying, you never know. With Chris Pine and Jessica Alba and Ed Helms, we're not getting a theatrical release.
Right.
That was like a free. We thought, how'd that happen? But, you know, it's out of your hands. When you start getting into stuff where you're dealing with the studios,
yeah,
you know, it's out of your hands. They own the shop. You know, they own it. So
and I watch, you know, 95% of what I watch, you know, at home via Netflix or VOD of some sort. You know, so I completely, you know, I'm sure that there are more people like me than not these days, too, that are watching most of the stuff at home. So, you know, the theater experience is not necessarily the same as what it once was as far as being like the place
yeah.
to see a movie.
I don't even, yeah. I rarely go out to the theater. I do the same thing. I watch it at home. You know, I can pause it when I want.
I see every new kids movie in the theater, but that's, you know, that's not because I choose to.
Yeah, there's also too many distractions. You know, the problem with movies now is, you know, people don't realize it, but when they check their cell phone, that light, man, that lights up the whole. You know, so there's too many distractions. So I think it's going to be a problem for the theaters. And then with all the piracy, with the popcorn times and all that kind of stuff, the world, you know, the younger generation that's a lot more tech savvy, why would they even go? They can just download it for nothing.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, that's definitely true. And, you know, the main reason I bring my kids to all the kids' movies is that we have a little, you know, rehabbed historic theater in town that actually, even though they charge $3 a movie, actually gets first run on most kids' movies. And
yeah.
So it's pretty incredible to go see, like, Zootopia and spend $9 on free tickets. So, you know, that's why we went and did that. But, you know, that's pretty much, they only really play family-friendly stuff because that's their motive, you know.
Right, right.
That's how they
I mean, I remember that, too. You know, and that's why if you ask me whether I write or not, okay, the last studio standing is going to be Disney.
Right.
For that simple reason, you know, their ancillary income from all their other lunch boxes and stuff is insane.
Right.
When you think about what they did, you know, if you look at the Disney, it's really interesting. And I don't know do you have boys or girls or what do you have?
I have two little boys.
Okay. So, yeah, so did I. I have two boys.
Okay.
So if you look at what Disney did, it's fascinating, right? Somewhere around 2000-ish, right?
Okay.
Look at the Disney films that came out. Disney films. They're all female heroes. Frozen,
yeah.
You know, all that stuff. They're all female heroes. Then when they bought Pixar, Pixar is all boy shit. Okay?
Yeah.
Right? And now they bought Star Wars. Okay?
Right.
So
and yeah, that's insane, yeah.
Okay, so and ESPN, okay? So they own the boy market, they own the girl market, they own the tweener market with the Star Wars, and they own live TV because the only thing that you don't TiVo is sports.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So they're going to be the last guy standing. These other guys, and you're going to see the land value in L.A. is too expensive. You're going to start seeing back lots at these studios become, you know, high-rise condo lofts.
Yeah.
It's over for these. It's over. It's over for the big studios. It's just, it's freaking over. And
so that's why something like the old Roger Corman, Jason Blum model actually makes sense.
Because
yeah, pumping out, you know. Like, you know, you were saying that you've got, you know, what, six Paranormal Activity movies at this point?
Yeah.
And
not,
none of them cost more than, like, $2 million to make, you know. And, you know, the first one cost, like, $100,000 or something ridiculous like that. You know,
yeah.
I mean, and it obviously that one made, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and launched this franchise. And, you know, that model, you know, is great. In this economy, because it doesn't cost anything to make a film. I mean, $1 million is a lot to me, but for a film, it's not. You know,
and also if you,
yes.
Jason's got a lot of films that he's made that are just sitting on a shelf and aren't getting out because they didn't come out as well. But the studios, you know, he's the golden child. I mean, he can greenlight a movie in 5 minutes because his movies are so cheap, and he's made enough. He's made so much money for Paramount and for Universal. Right, I mean, one of his little movies, like one of the movies, like The Purge or Insidious, and those kind of films.
Right.
They made enough money where Jason could make 50 shitty movies, and they'd still be friends. You know.
Yeah.
And he, what makes his model so fascinating and so interesting, is because he does make them on the lowest, you know, low tier for the unions and stuff. So basically, you know, most of his movies are $2 to $3 million in the $2 to $3 million box.
Right.
And he gets some pretty freaking talented actors.
Names and big actors, yeah.
And directors, and his crew is great because, you know what? A lot of these people are willing to work for a hell of a lot less money to go to sleep in their own bed at night and be able to go to the soccer game with their daughter than to be, you know, go 6 weeks and be shooting in Wyoming.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, there's something to be said about not being a slave to the studio. There's something to say about, you know, the short-term turnaround. You're right. It makes a lot of sense. you know, you can still have your life.
Yeah, well, that's what, and it all kind of fit together. Jason was, you know, it was timing, but at the same time, he took it by the horns, and, you know, he's done great. And God knows how long it'll hold up, but, you know, he's done great.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, as I said, it's always very reminiscent of Corman, you know, and just the way he just, and, you know, Corman has easily as many or more crappy movies than he has good ones. No, definitely more. It's not even a question, actually. But that.
Yeah, it was a different time too. I mean.
Yeah. Of course. But I mean, it's pretty cool to see someone replicate that model and make it, or not even just replicate it, but bring it to this time and actually update that model and be able to use it in a way. And one of the things that I love about Bloom is, you know, Blumhouse really does sometimes take a chance on a lot of unknown directors and really helps them out too. I mean, like he really has had launched some careers, you know, and that's pretty cool too, you know. So
no doubt. I mean, he's a smart, you know, he's got a great staff. I mean, it's not all Jason, trust me, but he's got a great staff of workers that keep that thing together, because it's a well-oiled machine. Let me tell you something, man. They'll have 7 movies going at once, and that's pretty remarkable.
That is crazy. Wow.
So,
that sounds like a lot. I mean, one movie sounds like a lot to me, but that many at a time is insane. But so if people wanted to check out a little bit about what you're about or some of your films and what you've done, where would they go to check that out?
I think it's just IMDb me. That's probably your best thing. And then, you know, I got a YouTube channel where I posted some stupid stuff. I don't have any, you know, big
on. If anybody wants to see Devil Takes a Holiday, it's up there.
Yes, it is. I put it up there actually for some of the actors who are asking me. Because some of them are still working. I mean, Brian Finney, who plays Corky, that guy still gets a lot of work. You'll see him in a lot of commercials.
Okay.
He's on that show. He's got a recurring role on that show, Turn, where he plays plays a British general or something.
Huh.
Some of them are still working. Most of them are not. I keep in touch with a few of them, but most of them are not. In fact, most of the crew people are. Yeah, it's just time. That's 20 years ago, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So it's a long time. A lot of things happened in 20 years.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, I'm only in my 30s, so 20 years ago I was, you know, a teenager, preteen. So, you know, I mean, it's a completely different world to me. So I completely get that. Yeah. Did you keep in touch with Vic until he passed away? Did you keep in touch with Vic until he passed away?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's not like I saw him every week, but absolutely.
Right.
He was, he has a stepson that I keep in touch with as well.
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, if you want some really freaking Victor Wong stories, I'll be, you know, if you want to talk
I'll definitely have to see if you can pass my information along to him or something. That'd be great. But I really appreciate, you know, talking today. You gave me some interesting insight about the system too, which is cool, because I think that's something a lot of people like to hear about, because it's not something, you know, if you haven't worked in the industry that you know anything about. And this podcast is going to be paired up with another indie director from Australia who does kind of like modern exploitation stuff, you know, very fun, off-the-wall exploitation horror. And I think it will dovetail pretty well, because he's, you know, completely divorced from any studio system. So we can kind of see two different worlds together, which is really nifty. So I guess that's really all I have for you today. You have anything else you want to share with everybody?
No, not really.
Style. Godfather of Little China, king and the warrior. In My name is Eric Bresler. I am the curator and director of programming for the Philadelphia Mausoleum of Contemporary Art and our in-house film festival, the Cinadelphia Film Festival, which is now entering its fourth year.
Cool.
The CFF's kind of spun out of our regular Philomoca programming. We're known for having very diverse events, you know, everything from film to performance art to burlesque. You know, we're known for hosting a lot of subversive, weird things. And the film festival is kind of all of my interests in film concentrated over the span of 1 month. So we do that April of every year.
Are you involved in the other events at Philomoca too? Or are you primarily the film guy? Or
No, I run all aspects of Philomoca.
We actually just ran a review on the website of the Steve Taylor and the Danielson Foyle show.
Oh, cool! Yeah, that was that was an outside rental, but yeah.
Okay.
I kind of approve and accept all events.
Okay, cool. My friend who went and covered it, who's a writer for the site, he said that it was just such a fitting venue for such a weird kind of show. I don't know if you're familiar with either Steve Taylor or Danielson, but kind of wacky histories, especially Danielson. Danielson's a very, different folk kind of artist. So definitely an interesting setting. And I've actually never been inside Philomoca. I've driven past it about 3,000 times, probably. and I know it has the building with the eraser head on the side, right?
Right. That was one of the first things I did when I took over.
And they call that neighborhood the Eraser Hood, don't they?
They do, due to David Lynch having lived just a few blocks away from our building when he was at PAFA as a student.
Are you a big David Lynch fan?
I am. I have been my entire life, which is one of the very first events that I organized for Philomoca was a kind of Lynch-themed celebration that was in 2012, and we host it every fall. And, it's like it's an art show, and then there's bands and performers, and it's all related to David Lynch in some manner.
Oh,
and
cool.
I think it kind of climaxed last year when Lynch stopped by.
Oh, my gosh.
Which was a real thrill. Yeah, being a lifelong fan, it was a big deal. And then the headliner for last year's event was I kind of went all out, and I found the Lady in the Radiator from Eraserhead.
Oh, my gosh, that's amazing.
In Heaven. Yeah, and so she headlined, and she sang In Heaven Live with the backing of a 10-piece chamber orchestra.
Oh, my gosh, that's
cool.
Funny. That is really cool.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, the conversation coincides with the fact that I'm doing a little assignment on David Lynch for Synapse, because I kind of get this little assignment from, I had mentioned before we started recording, that I'm friends with Liam O'Donnell, who writes for that site and is part of, the Philadelphia film scene. And he gives me little assignments, what we call Liam's Film School. And he basically said, I want, how familiar are you with David Lynch? I was like, I've seen a few of his films. And he's like, well, you're going to get more familiar. So I'm watching five of his films in chronological order, and I watched Eraserhead for the first time in my life only a few weeks ago. It's I don't know. I'm still processing it. I'm probably going to be processing it for a long time. I'd say I liked it, but I would also say I don't really know what I thought of it. I mean, very, very interesting film. And since then, I've now watched Elephant Man and Blue Velvet as well. And those were both my first times watching them as well. So I could see the progression of his style in the three films, and Blue Velvet being a really phenomenal film. And the other two kind of, I see where they led up to that, So very interesting artist that I'm really excited to get more into. And by the time, your next David Lynch festival rolls around, I'll probably be head over heels and getting my butt down there. So
very good.
Very excited. So the film festival, the Philadelphia Film Festival, in the fourth year, you said, starts just next week, right?
Yeah, next Thursday is opening night, and we have Joe Bob Briggs coming in for it.
Oh, wow. That's kind of cool. And is there a film that he's going to be introducing or being part of that event in the first night?
Well, it's actually kind of a long program. So around the first hour or so, it'll just be a kind of informal chat,
cool.
Kind of an open Q&A where we go over his career as a writer and as a TV host. And I've created a bunch of video montages of his TV work. So yeah, that'll be fun. And, you know, everyone who's a fan can just feel free to ask him what they want. And then there'll
That's
be
awesome.
An opportunity for photos and autographs. And then we're going to screen The Warriors. But we're going to screen the cut as it was shown on Monster Vision, which means that are you familiar with The Warriors?
So we were talking about, you know, Warriors Come Out and Play, that movie, right?
Like the Walter Hill film, the, you know, New York City gang film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm very familiar with that. Okay, I just want to make sure I was seeing that there's not another Warriors I'm unfamiliar with. No, yeah, yes. I am very familiar with that film, yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to show the Monster Vision cut, which actually contains scenes that are not in the director's cut.
Oh, that's
cool. And includes, of course, the interstitials where Joe Bob pops up and tells jokes or tells things about the film.
Awesome.
So, yeah, that'll be a lot of fun. There was a director's cut of that film released a few years back, which...
I'm pretty sure that's the cut I own.
It's got the cartoon comic book bookends,
yes.
which they added,
yes.
which I don't really understand why they added those, but happy to show it the way I first saw it.
Awesome, awesome.
Yeah,
I probably I know I saw it before the director's cut was released, but I don't think I owned it until the director's cut was released. So
yeah,
and I mean I own most of my movies digitally these days. I have the little kids and they ruin all my physical media, so
sure.
I don't have a lot of physical media anymore. Although I
mm-hmm.
did just buy a Blu-ray for the first time because now that I'm writing more for Synapse, a lot of screeners come in Blu-ray, and I'm like, well, I guess I need to find a way to watch them. So, so I'm actually, you know, I said you guys can welcome me to 2008 now, you know, I'm here, but,
yeah.
nonetheless, yeah, I do love the movie The Warriors, and it definitely sounds interesting to see it in its original form. I don't know if I have or if I haven't seen that, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, yeah, what's interesting is that, of course, it was on TNT, so it is edited for content.
Okay. So not exactly
but, you know,
original form.
Yeah, like, it's a weird form, because, you know, like, when they edit out certain scenes of violence or, you know, language, they have to make up that time with other things, which is why you often have these TV cuts that have deleted scenes that have never
right.
made it, you know, to any format. So, yeah, it's interesting in that regard.
That is really interesting. I remember watching, I think it was, Billy Madison on TNT once, and there were these scenes that I'd never seen, and I'd seen the movie maybe a dozen times already. I'm like, where the heck did this? There's like a softball scene or something where they're playing softball. I'm like, this doesn't happen. What?
Sure.
And it's because they cut out so many other little bits and stuff that I guess they have to make up that time. It totally makes sense, but, you know, of course, then they just have the dubbed versions where, you know, you watch Friday and they just say forget you all the time. But
yeah.
nonetheless, so what other events are coming up? I mean, a lot of them. How long is Cinadelphia go? How long is the festival?
It runs the 7th through the 23rd with
okay.
A pre-festival screening this Saturday, April 2nd at Viva Video. And then next Wednesday, the night before opening night, we're doing an open gallery.
Cool.
Every year we have a... an art show of some sort that ties in with the festival. And this year's is an exhibition of film posters from Ghana, which are known for being insane and beautiful and just plain weird.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So that's going to be,
are they of films? Are they of American films?
Yes. The ones we're just, they run the gamut, of course,
okay.
but the ones we're displaying are all kind of skewed hand painted posters of films that, my type of film lover will instantly recognize.
Okay, cool. No, that's really cool. I definitely think that sounds like a very worthwhile, fun event to check out. And especially if, you know, somebody's really a film geek, I'm sure that that poster art and stuff is something that a lot of people are really into.
I'm a big poster collector, and there's a place in Chicago, the Deadly Prey Gallery, and they just specialize in hand-painted posters from Ghana. So we flew out there a couple months ago, and yeah, I'm just really excited to be able to display some of their collection.
That's really awesome. So with the Philadelphia Film Festival, is everything based out of the Philomoka then?
Yeah. Yeah, awesome. In years past, we've been all over the city, but I think last year we started just centering it at Philomoka. It's, you know, less running around for me.
Yeah, no, I get it. I'm just curious. So so in the past, it's kind of bounced around, but now you're kind of just centering everything there, which so maybe it's easier for people that are interested in coming. They only need to know one address. You know,
yeah, you got it. And I've always supported a film festival that does not kind of compete against itself, you know, with multiple
right.
screenings at multiple venues at the same time. Yeah, that's just a matter of preference. But I really like how the festival has evolved to just become Philomoka-centric, but still with, like, the most diverse programming imaginable.
Yeah, I did notice I guess I'll get into some of the programming. One of the things that jumped out at me was a short film that's a sequel to another short film by a 13-year-old who, is that the correct age, 12, 13, who hangs around the Philomoka?
Oh, of course, yes, Undercover Cops 2.
Yes, yes. And, I actually heard him speak on the Cinepunk podcast, and then I noticed in your program that, you know, his long-awaited sequel to Undercover Cops, I guess, you know, coming out. And that sounds like a really fun thing. Am I correct? Was he 13? Is that the correct age?
Yeah, yeah. He was 12 when we filmed it last summer.
Nice.
Yeah, he's great. That's Little Sean. He's our mascot. Everybody in the neighborhood knows him. His face is painted on our garage door, so if you ever drive by, that's his big smiling
cool.
face.
How did he get involved
yeah.
with hanging around Philomoka and doing stuff with Philomoka?
Well, actually, he was involved with the building long before I was. He lives right on the corner, and back when the building was used by the record producer Diplo, he used to have these big parties outside, and Lil Sean used to, you know, run out of his house and just hang out with the, you know, thousands of people that parked on.
Oh, that's cool. So he's been hanging out since he was like little.
Yeah, yeah, there's a video of the first Mad Decent block party, and it quickly flashes to this dunk booth, and it happens to be Little Sean when he was, like, 5 years old in the dunking booth, which is really funny. So, yeah, like, right when I started Philomoka in, 2012, he used to just ride his bike by and stop by and talk, and now he's, you know, he's probably our most loyal volunteer.
That's awesome. Well, that's really
yeah.
cool. I mean, and that just shows, like, the kind of community... you know, atmosphere and that Philomoka is obviously about, you know, being part of the community there, which is really awesome to have, you know, a neighborhood kid who's kind of like your biggest cheerleader. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've put him on stage and had him dress up in weird costumes, and he's always up for it. So
that's so cool. That's so cool. And, so that's one of many, you know, film screening. What are some of the other events that you're most stoked about?
Well, I grew up in northern New York, just miles from Canada, so I've been a lifelong Degrassi fan.
Okay.
And very excited to bring in the guy who could be considered the star of the original two Degrassi series. So that's happening next Friday. His name is Pat Mastriani. He played this character named Joey Jeremiah. And if you're a Degrassi fan, then you're quite familiar with him. So really excited that he's coming in from Canada,
okay,
going
cool.
to host a retrospective. Some of my very favorite filmmakers of all time all happen to be coming in. So we have Trent Harris coming in, who made Reuben and Ed and the Beaver Trilogy. That's really exciting. We have Frank Henenlotter coming in, of course, who made Basket Case and Frankenhooker. He's showing his new film. Yeah, tons of cool
stuff.
Did he
do the sequels to Basket Case, too, or was he just
yep.
the first one?
No, he did all three.
Okay.
All, I think, are worthwhile in their own ways. and, yeah, like, just we have DJ Doug Pound coming in, who's a big Adult Swim regular, really funny guy.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of public access television.
Okay.
It's kind of one of the things I'm known for curating, and we're doing retrospective of one of the greatest public access shows of all time called Stairway to Stardom, which was out of New York City in the 80s. And it spawned, in recent years, it spawned just so many viral videos from Lucille Cataldo's hairdresser to, this song called Crackhead by BJ the Messenger.
It sounds really familiar to me. I grew up in New York City suburbs, so I'm sure that's why it sounds familiar to me.
It's one of those things that's like been covered by everyone from NPR to the AV Club. And like, if you see the videos, you instantly know what it is. But by name, a lot of people, I think, just can't place it. But yeah, so I went all out and I tried to hunt down as many performers as I could. And the band that did the theme song is reuniting to perform live. And the original co-host will be there. Yeah, it's a whole thing.
That's awesome.
I've been working on that for like 6 months now.
Awesome. That's pretty cool. And I mean, that's something that's super niche and obscure, but the people that are, you know, will come out will be so excited to see it. So that's awesome.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, you got a lot of really wide variety of stuff. One of the things that caught my eye was the film Sympathy for the Devil, which I'd never heard of until I looked at your list, but then I started doing some looking into, and I'm a nerd for the occult, and I'm also, cults, the occult, things like that. I've always been really into that kind of stuff. You know, I, in Philadelphia, you know, spent a lot of time researching, you know, the Father Divine and stuff that, you know, he did and all these different little cults and things. And so when I saw, you know, this, I said, oh man, this sounds kind of interesting and somewhat familiar. I started digging into it. And that's what jumped out at me personally. Is that event being, is that just a screening, or is there anybody coming down to be part of that event?
Yeah, our programmer Sarah actually found that film, and when she recommended it, I immediately checked it out, and yeah, I was really impressed. The director himself is flying in from the UK, I believe, and then we have one of the founding members of the Process Church coming in. It's crazy. He used to go by Father Malachi. So he's actually one of the public leaders of the group. So he's coming in, and then a woman who traveled with them when they were making their world travels is coming in also. Wow. Yeah, first time we've ever had a real, like, legitimate cult member in Philomoka.
we got a cult leader coming down to chat.
I'm assuming at this point in his life he's not,
if he's interested to come and talking about it, I'm sure he's like moved into a different realm of his life, I'd assume,
That's one of the most interesting things about the documentary is that all of these, you know, former like demonic cult figures, they all come across as like kind of like normal, intelligent guys now who are able to separate themselves from the past and really analyze what they went through and why they did it.
That makes it way more interesting too. I mean, you know, for people to be able to have had the firsthand experience, yet also be able to step back and look at it from an interesting and scientific, objective way. That's what really interests me about the film and why I'm real stoked on it. And like I said, you know, in our pre-conversation, I don't get down to the city on my own without kids very often. So for me, I had to pick out a couple events that looked the most exciting and most interesting to me. And that's the first one that jumped out. So I definitely intend on being at that one. And that now, especially hearing more about who's going to be there, I'm really, really stoked on it. So
It's going to be a good one. And by the way, we do have a really good event for kids. On Saturday, April 16th, we're hosting this Chicago-based kind of children's dance party called Chicagogo.
Oh, cool.
They're celebrating their 20th anniversary this year. It's a public access show out of Chicago's.
Ooh.
Had everyone on from like the Pixies to Fugazi to Godspeed You. They're filming a live episode at Philomoka, and the musical guests are the Dead Milkmen and Bunny Sigler. Yeah.
Oh man. I'm getting together with some friends of the family who have kids as well, who live in Cherry Hill. Maybe we're just gonna have to meet up there instead of going out to their place. So that sounds like an event to me.
Yeah, if they actually like to dance, bring them in.
Yeah, definitely. We're gonna be actually out at Philomoka, and unrelated to the Philadelphia Film Fest, on the 1st of May to see Greg from the Bouncing Souls Kids Project Playdate.
Oh, good. I booked that. Very good.
Awesome. Yeah, we've seen them a few times, and actually, Greg and Shanti know my kids by first name now. So, you know, and I've covered them a few times for my website, and, you know, I got to have them on this podcast. And it's funny, I you know, growing up in Jersey, a punk fan, you know, to me, the Bouncing Souls are like, God, you know, like I grew up with those are like, you know, that was one of my bands, you know, and and for me to get to like chat with Greg, it was one of the few times in a long time that I could say I legitimately was like having to hold back my like geeky fandom to talk to him. Like I was really like, oh my God, I'm talking to Greg. Oh my God. You know, and it was so much fun. And then when I met them, and they do very intimate, you know, shows for families and kids, because, you know, while the Souls have a huge name, not a ton of people know Playdate, you know, and so their events are a lot smaller. And I went to see them at Peanut Butter and Jams at the Queen in Wilmington, which is a kids event that World Cafe Live does. And there were maybe 20 kids there. And now both of them went out of their way to get to know them personally. That was really cool to me, you know, and I'm very, very, very excited to come see them again. And I was excited to see that it's at Philomoka, because I've been wanting to get out to their venue. Of course, now I'm going to be there sooner than that because of the Philadelphia Film Festival. But I still, like I said, I hadn't been out to the venue yet, and it calls out to me. It looks really cool, so
awesome.
I'm excited.
In just a quick related note, the woman in that band, Greg's wife, I believe.
Yeah, Shanti. Yeah.
Shanti, yeah, she is actually the daughter of the couple that made one of the great no-budget 80s horror films called Boarding House.
I don't think I've
if you've never heard of it, totally understandable, but absolutely bonkers no-budget horror film, which they wrote and starred in, and they were also in a weirdo 70s band called Lightstorm, so I was chatting with her about that, because that'd be like the craziest parents to ever have, so
yeah,
I'm really
well,
impressed by that.
That's funny. That's really funny. They actually, Greg and Shanti, when they're not on tour, live in a house that her parents gave to them out in Idaho, in like the middle of nowhere. Because when I talked to them for the podcast, we couldn't talk on the cell phone because they didn't get service. I had to call them at their home number. They're like in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, so it's kind of funny, but. But yeah, that's really, really cool. And I mean, so besides, you know, the event I just mentioned and the film festival, you know, you guys do a really wide variety of stuff over at Philomoka. It's a really different kind of space. You mentioned a little bit about it. What's kind of the concept of what you guys are doing? You know, where did you get the idea to just kind of go all out in different directions?
Well, diversity was always what I had in mind. I come from a kind of a background of like booking, you know, basement punk shows in West Philly and all that. And while I still do that kind of thing to a degree, Philly, in my eyes at least, always lacked a kind of all-purpose space where, you know, not only do you embrace the kind of indie punk scene, but also you embrace the equivalent of that in, you know, the visual arts or the performance arts.
Right.
And Philomoka is really just one big empty room, so it can be used for so many different purposes. So right when I took over, I started booking, you know, not just music bands, but also films and weirdo performers, and really played up the David Lynch related angle, and played up the fact that we're in this really unique building that used to be, you know, a showroom for mausoleums and tombstones.
Right.
Oh, thanks. Oh, the festival program guide just arrived at my door.
Nice. Funny timing.
Yeah. Timing.
We're talking about it, so that's pretty awesome.
So diversity has always been the key, and I really don't think that Philly has another all-purpose space like this. Or I should say, it didn't used to. The past year or so, a lot of outsider venues have taken our model and kind of copied it, which is a good thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not about competition. It's about, you know,
right,
growing the community, you know, and that's really cool. I mean, I'm a punk kid at heart. Grew up in the North Jersey scene in the early to mid 90s, through even the late 90s when I finished high school. And And so, you know, I completely get the whole DIY ethos and kind of supporting, you know, all that stuff. And now that I'm older, my interests are much more diverse.
Oh, you too.
You know,
sorry.
Now that I'm older, my interests are much more diverse. So it's interesting to me to hear, you know, somebody or see somebody doing this where it's not just about the punk shows and the stuff like that, but also about, like, you know, the indie film scene and other performing arts, because, you know, that does seem like a thing that doesn't get enough support. And you definitely want to support, I think, a lot of the independent folks who don't get the exposure that they should.
Completely, yeah. You know, there's a lot of people out there, struggling artists who just don't have a place to, you know, showcase what they do. And I've always been more than willing to help them out. As far as I, you know, I always say the weirder, the better. so, yeah.
Well, and speaking of weirder, this episode of the podcast, you're going to be paired up with another conversation I have with a guy named Leon Korkus. And he was a director, or is still a director, of independent films. And I stumbled across him because another kind of project that I just gave myself for the year was I'm going to watch every film that Victor Wong is in. And why? I don't know. Probably because on the first of the year, I just happened to not intentionally watch back-to-back Big Trouble in Little China and The Golden Child, which are, by the way, a great double feature together. And I'm like, you know what? I love Victor Wong. He's awesome. I need to watch all his films. So I looked it up, and something like, you know, a full-length feature film, it's under 30. It's really not a huge number, but because he didn't start acting so late in life. And this movie I stumbled across called The Devil Takes a Holiday, it was up on YouTube. So I watch it, and sure enough, I couldn't even log it in my letterbox without adding it because it wasn't even in the database. And so I started hunting down the director to get some more information. And his name's Leon Korkus, and he talked to me, and it just turns out that he met Victor because they both had kids in – oh, no. His kid was in a daycare that Victor and his wife ran.
Hmm.
And so he's like, hey, I love you in this and this and this. Can you be in my indie film? And he's like, yeah, sure. And they actually wrote the film with him in mind for this part of, you know, typical Victor Wong, crazy old man who says wise things despite the fact he's also crazy. You know,
sure.
And that's essentially, I think, like 90% of the roles that he played. But it's pretty cool. I think it'll be an interesting pairing because he's obviously got a very obscure bent. He's only directed a couple films, but, you know, this Devil Takes a Holiday, which, by the way, is up on YouTube and you should check out if you like weird, is this really obscure, I don't even know what to call it. I guess you'd call it horror, but it's not necessarily scary per se, but I don't really know what to call it. But a very interesting film from the mid-90s. And so I think it would pair really well with the idea that, you know, you're kind of interesting and the weirder the better. Kind of going from that, is there any event in the last 3, 4, or 5, 4 years that jumps out at you as one of the weirdest? Or what are some of the weirdest events that were like, you just were like, wow, this is weird but really awesome?
Yeah, you know, I love weird just in general. yeah, like the guests that I've spent a lot of money to bring in, you know, it's everyone from Jan Terry, you know, the kind of
Jan
outsider.
Terry?
Yeah, are you familiar? She, if you go to YouTube and type in worst music video ever, hers is the one that comes up.
Okay.
I'll check lovely that out. Woman. Yeah, great lady out of Chicago, lives in California now. We brought her in to perform live and had a great house. Everyone had fun. I brought in the recently deceased multiple-time alien abductee, Riley Martin, who had a long-running radio show. He's unfortunately passed away last year, but he had a long career just chatting about how many times he was abducted by aliens, and that he had this whole alien mythology, like tons of merchandise related to it that you could buy.
Well, he probably knew a lot about aliens if he'd been abducted multiple times.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's aliens that only he has ever known about. and he always did it all with kind of a wink and a nod, which made him very charming.
So, you know, I mean, maybe somewhat self-aware of what he was. So that's pretty awesome. Those some really interesting. How about on the film side? Are there any films you showed that were like some of your favorite over the last 4 years? Maybe ones that you discovered, you know, just before you seen them, or even maybe you booked without having seen them before.
I don't think I've ever booked a film that I haven't seen before.
Okay.
I've never blind booked as far as I can remember. But two notable film things, a couple months ago, I think back in, November, we had the director of House in the,
awesome.
You know,
Things
yeah, insane day. Japanese film.
Oh, House Who?
Yeah, House Who.
That's awesome. Oh my God. That's crazy. In fact, you know what? I saw that event. And I saw it like literally the day of, and I was like, damn it. Cause I had, that's an awesome film. Ridiculous. Like one of the most weird things I've ever seen in my life. Ridiculous. Yeah. Oh,
yeah,
that's so
that
cool.
That was a real treat. I mentioned earlier that I'm a poster collector. So I have, Japanese posters of a few of his other films that he gladly signed. And, his daughter,
cool.
You know, who wrote Houseu when she was 8 or 9 or whatever.
Oh my God.
Was there
that,
with
that
him.
Kinda
and,
makes sense. As to why the way it is, then if it was written by an 8 or 9 year old, that kind of sheds a little light on it.
Yeah, totally. So that was a real treat. But as far as like really obscure, worthwhile stuff, the Philadelphia Film Festival 2 years ago opened with this film called Video Wars, which does not have an entry on IMDb or anything, and it was this great Philly shot spy spoof from the early 80s that a friend of mine's uncle made, and he messaged me one day and was like, hey, have you ever heard of this film? Apparently my uncle directed it. And so I found a copy, and I was just like, oh my God, nobody's ever heard of this. This is amazing. And I transcribed the end credits and then just started contacting, you know, every name in the credits, and I managed to find the writer and the producer and the star, and you know, it never really had a proper premiere. It kind of, it made the film, which was financed by who are possibly some shady South Philly types. leave
Philly
it at that. And,
yeah, I got you.
Well, judging by the crowd that came out for the screening, yeah. But everyone was really friendly. And they never,
That's
like,
awesome.
Had a proper premiere. They showed it at Cannes, and then it got, like, a very limited VHS release in the early 80s. And then just went into obscurity. So, to gather all these people together, you know, they were really psyched.
That's
and
really
actually
cool.
The film was shot by Christopher Spieth, who directed Malatesta's Carnival of Blood, which recently was re-released.
I actually just saw that very recently. Yeah. I think didn't they just get a new re-release recently?
Yeah, it's in a 3-disc Arrow set that came out.
Yeah.
And he's actually, he lives right outside of Philly.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's how he
cool.
was like kind of worked for hire for him, and he told me that he had never even seen the finished film, like he shot it and then just backed off.
Oh, that's pretty obscure. Oh my gosh, that's fun.
Yeah, that was a fun
wow.
one.
That is really fun, and you know, I mean, I think we live in a really cool time where some of these films that have been, you know, all over the place and unable to be found or, you know, somewhat tracked downable because of the internet and. You know, things like, you know, you see, you know, Garage House releasing, you know, their first film in Ninja Busters. And, you know, nobody saw that film until, you know, recently because it was, like, gone for 20 years with, like, one or two copies of it existing, you know. And, like, that's really cool, you know. And I think we live in a really cool time where people can do that, you know. And it's exciting to be able to be part of that time. And you know, I think it's awesome that you're you know, really a big part of that scene here in Philly. And so I guess my kind of last question for you so you can get on with your day is how can people check out the festival? How can they check out Philomoka? You know, what's the best way to get a hold of you guys?
Sure. So online you can go to CinedelphiaFilmFestival.com. That's CINEDelphia. For Philomoka, we are philomoka.org, and that, of course, stands for the Philadelphia Mausoleum of Contemporary Art. Other than that, I've always kind of tried to preserve a secretive nature, I guess, which is why when you come to Philomoka, there is no sign outside. There's no indication that we are the building where you're trying to go.
which I always thought kind of, you know, made things a little more special. The idea has always been that you see this, you know, 120-year-old exterior that says mausoleums on it, and you're like, is this really the building? And then you come in, it's this kind of, you know, big surprise inside.
Mm-hmm. That's part of the thing that makes me so excited is that, yeah. I you know, there don't exist a lot of, you know, pictures and things about what it all looks like. All I know is there's a mausoleum, David Lynch, with a eraser head painted on the side. That's what I know. And
sure.
And so that's what people, if they're coming down to the festival, got to look for. You know.
Yeah. That's what, you know, the most common thing I always hear after events is, you know, when did that happen? Why didn't I hear about that? And it's like, you really just got to keep track of us online to see what we're up to.
Awesome. And so, you know, I definitely will throw some links up so people can definitely check that out.
Awesome.
And hopefully I get a chance to come out and, you know, see the Sympathy for the Devil and maybe some other stuff this festival. And I really appreciate that you came on here. And is there anything else that you have to say or share or any final words you'd want to leave the listeners with?
No, hey, I just want to thank you for having me on. And, you know, we only survive as a, you know, as a space due to people like you spreading the word and people coming out and risking their evenings for something that could be somewhat wild. So we really appreciate
awesome.
That.
Well, and that is, so I definitely will check the, you guys out, and I hopefully a handful of the listeners that are from the Philly area will come on out too.
Please allow me to introduce myself. Yeah.